Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the growing possibility that Donald Trump could be put on trial for treason, given the extraordinary lengths he goes to in making excuses for Putin and his unwillingness to lift the cloud of illegitimacy that hangs over his presidency, a refusal to clear the air, which suggests Trump has something to hide. Scott Horton, a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security, joins us to discuss the latest evidence that Donald Trump is the main beneficiary of the most successful covert operation in history, run by a former KGB colonel who managed to get his asset, Donald Trump, placed in the White House as the head of the most powerful nation on earth. We will examine the roll-up of America's network of spies inside the top levels of the Russian government, which has resulted in many senior FSB and former KGB officers arrested and some murdered, and the coincidence that Putin's purge began shortly after officials in the Trump administration were given access to secret information on sources and methods inside Russia that were providing intelligence to the U.S. Then we look into the role of Eric Prince, the founder of Blackwater, the notorious mercenary army and cutout for intelligence paramilitary operations, who was a close friend of Stephen Bannon and the brother of Trump's nominee for Education Secretary, Betsy DeVos. Joining us is Robert Young Pelton, who was hired by Prince to write his biography. He is the author of License to Kill, Hired Guns and the War on Terror, and The Adventurist, and is a strategic advisor to MOAS, the Migrant Offshore Aid Station, which operates ships to rescue migrants at sea. We'll examine whether Bannon will use Prince's shadowy outfit, now called Frontier Services Group, to provide the spark to start a new war. Then finally, we will speak with an expert on offshore tax havens, kleptocracy, and pirate banking, investigative economist James Henry. He is the co-founder of DC Reports and the author of Blood Bankers, and joins us to discuss Trump's nominee for Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross's partnership in a Cyprus bank with a Russian mobster and money launderer, and whether Trump is the secret beneficiary of a recent sale of 19% of the Russian oil giant Rosneft, the proceeds of which went into a myriad of hidden accounts in the Cayman Islands. And joining us now is Scott Horton, who's a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He served as counsel to Andrei Sakharov and Elena Bonner, among other activists in the former Soviet Union, and serves on the American branch of the International Law Association and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Horton.
Great to be with you, Ian.
And Scott, when you make the charge that the President of the United States could be put on trial for treason, you have to have be able to back that up a little bit. And let's begin with the obvious reason to have a great deal of suspicion here, and that is that, particularly after Congressman Lewis has remarked about Trump not having any legitimacy because of Russia's involvement in helping elect him and hurt Hillary Clinton, you would think that Donald Trump would want to clear the air and remove this cloud of illegitimacy that hovers over him. But he's done the opposite. He's doubled down, and extraordinarily, just on Fox News with his friend Bill O'Reilly, Trump was asked, O'Reilly mentioned that Putin is a killer. And Trump came to Putin's defense and said, oh, no, here in the United States, we've done all kinds of terrible things. So something is going on here, and I believe there is some growing evidence to indicate that there's a lot more to this Trump-Kremlin connection than meets the eye.
Well, I agree. I mean, I think it's breathtaking that Donald Trump, who has a nasty or unkind comment for everybody, indeed seems to have no compunction about criticizing in the most vociferous way even the Pope and his own political comrades, his own vice presidential candidate. But one exception here, the one man he will never utter a critical word of, and to whose defense he instantly leaps, and that is Vladimir Putin. And this is strange, and this strangeness goes back quite a ways. And I think recently, not just this interview with Bill O'Reilly, but events that have been unfolding over roughly the last month point to something really quite extraordinary. And I think we would start by going back to Christopher Steele, the British MI6, former MI6 agent, who prepared a dossier on Trump with some very dramatic revelations, which by and large media have not been able to corroborate. But we see now that in Russia there has been a very dramatic effort to identify and extinguish each of Christopher Steele's principal sources. And in particular, since the election of Trump and since people close to Trump have gotten access to the U.S. intelligence analysis, and of course a large part of that U.S. analysis has been focused on who are the sources of Christopher Steele. And Christopher Steele, of course, ran the MI6 operation in Russia and had a very extensive network at that time, which presumably he continued to use. We see suddenly some pretty prominent people in the Russian intelligence community disappearing. So, in fact, I would say, in particular, we see a KGB, FSB general found murdered in the back of his car. This was on Boxing Day. And then, you know, we've only learned much more recently that about the same time, within a 48-hour proximity to that killing, there were a number of other individuals apprehended. And one of them, another FSB general, a very well-known figure, Sergei Mikhailov, apprehended in a very dramatic way, dragged out of an FSB meeting with a bag placed over his head. And a number of other people being identified bit by bit in Russian and in Western media as being the target of investigations, disappearing from their workplace, and so forth. So it looks like, you know, we're looking at a roll-up by the Russians of individuals the Russians believe are their sources, and many individuals being rolled up within a very brief period of time. So this looks much like what happened in both the Aldrich Ames and Hansen cases.
Well, the question then is, is there a mole inside the CIA like Ames or like in the FBI, Hansen, or is this is the leaks coming from the Trump administration's National Security Council with pro-Russian people like Michael Flynn, Stephen Bannon, Sebastian Gorka, and Boris Epstein?
Yeah, I think the timing would suggest that that the leaks occur with the transition to the Trump team. So, of course, it would focus attention immediately on the new team, particularly the national security team that Trump has brought in. And one of the really striking things about that team from the beginning has been the proliferation of people with close ties to Russia and to Vladimir Putin in this innermost entourage around Trump. In fact, that's one of the most extraordinary things about his team. You listed some of the names. Of course, there are others as well. There's Carter Page. There's Paul Manafort. People who have, let's say, unofficial positions, but still seem in some capacity or another to be representing or acting for Trump, including in dealings with the Russians.
And again, I'm speaking with Scott Horton, who's a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He served as counsel to Andrei Sakharov and Elena Bonin, among other activists in the former Soviet Union, and serves on the American branch of the International Law Association and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. So let's go into go back in time to when the Russians may well first have recruited Donald Trump. Because the Soviet tourist operation, Intourist, that ran all of their hotels and travel arrangements into the former Soviet Union, that was run by the KGB. And I understand that back in the 1980s, Trump had first approached Intourist, which is again the KGB, develop hotels in the Soviet Union. So what do you know about that?
Well, that's correct. And in fact, on a few occasions in the past when Trump has been asked about Russia, he says he really doesn't know anything about Russia. He doesn't know anything about Putin. I mean, on other occasions he's contradicted that. One time he said, well, he knows something about Russia because he ran a Miss Universe contest there once. That's nonsense. In fact, if we go back and we systematically track his dealings with Russia, they're very extensive, and they go back certainly at least to 1987. So we know that 1987 Interest, which, as you correctly say, essentially was a KGB operation. It ran the hotels which foreigners had to stay at. In fact, there's an Interest museum in the Baltics where they show the way the KGB used Interest hotels to spy on visitors. Interest invited Trump at its expense to come to Moscow. He spent the better part of a week there, and he formally, it said, he was in discussions with them about setting up a set of Trump luxury hotels in Russia, which would be run by Interest. But it appears pretty clearly that they spent most of the time when he was there talking with him about the idea of Trump running for president or some other higher office. And in fact, he returned from that trip and almost immediately filed for an exploratory committee in New Hampshire. In fact, you'll find the records there for his filing in 1987. So he was thinking of running for president in 1988, and it seems he had dealings with Russian intelligence in that connection going back. So this is going back almost 30 years. And it goes forward from there, but it's off and on. I mean, there are long periods where nothing happens, and then he becomes active again. And more recently, it appears that beginning about 2005, 2006, their relationships became much more active and much deeper. And not only were there numerous visits by him and other members of his family and senior management to Russia and also Azerbaijan and Georgia and other places, but it appears that there was, from that period, an absolutely enormous flow of cash coming from Russia into the Trump business operation. And this is at a time when Trump had gone through his seventh bankruptcy, and the major banks that were financing him had turned the spigot. He was receiving no more money. So at that low point for Trump, when his entire business empire seemed to be on the basis of failing, suddenly a wall of cash coming out of Russia saved him.
Well, in terms of the purge of top KGB and FSB generals and other officials in cyber warfare or cyber espionage on the Russian side, in particular Oleg Yerovinkin, who was a former KGB general and FSB general, who was found dead in the backseat of his Lexus on Boxing Day in Moscow. He was a liaison between Igor Seshin, another KGB guy who basically was able to take over the stolen oil company Hudhoski, turn Yukos into Rosneft. And he is he's very close to Putin. And Yerovinkin was the liaison between Putin and Seshin. So clearly, if he was a spy for the U.S., which apparently is the case, that was an extremely valuable asset that the CIA had. That's gone. But, you know, there's also been 16 generals in the various law enforcement, the MIA, the MES, and the ICR. That's the Ministry of Emergency Situations, the Ministry of Internal Affairs, and the Investigative Committee. They were also purged as well. So this is a pretty deep kind of purge. Let's talk a little bit about Seshin and Rosneft, because they put up 19% of Rosneft's stock for sale to the public, and it was all sold through, basically a Western cutout, and all the proceeds ended up in a myriad of Cayman Island banks. So nobody knows who the ultimate beneficiaries were, but there's a rumor that the main beneficiary might well have been Donald Trump. So walk us through where it is. And, of course, James Henry, expert in offshore banking, will be joining us later in the program.
Yeah, I think when we look at these, the sources and the people who are being rolled up right now, they fall into two baskets generally in terms of their area of engagement. So one group is in the cyber espionage area, and this would have to do mostly with the report that Steele made, that the DNI confirmed in its report of hacking, very large-scale hacking attack that was launched by the Russians, focusing on DNC, but also many other targets inside the United States, with the aim of affecting or influencing the 2016 election. But the other basket has to do with this proposed transaction involving Rosneft. So I think, in fact, when I look at the entire dossier that Steele prepared, the single potentially most explosive item in it, that although not the one that gets, you know, the most lurid interest because of sexual allegations and so forth, has to do with Rosneft. So when you're looking for, you know, what motivates Trump and what causes him to never say an ill word about Putin, to be absolutely slavish in his following and support of Putin, most people are looking for a monetary incentive having been provided at some point. Of course, we already know about the hundreds of millions of dollars that were funneled, which in fact Trump company officials have acknowledged at some point. But in this dossier, the most specific allegation that's made has to do with this proffered sale of Rosneft, a 19.5% interest in Rosneft in particular, 5% brokerage fee specifically really having been offered to Trump in connection with this sale. Now, this is a 5% of one of the largest, if not the largest, oil and gas companies in the world. So we're talking about many billions of dollars in value. And that the deal is described in some detail. It's described as having been offered by Sechin, the head of Rosneft and a confidant of Putin, to Carter Page, who was described by Trump himself as his principal Russian advisor at that time, in a meeting that occurred in Moscow. His source is described as someone in a senior position within Rosneft. So this, you know, seems quite plausibly, it's clear that very few people would have known that much detail about the deal. But Oleg Yerovinkin, former FSB general and close confidant of Sechin, certainly would have been one of those people who would have known about it. So I guess the supposition is that he would have been the source. But I think in looking at the totality of the Steele dossier, this is one particular report where we would say the quality of the information that's covered in it, we know now based on things that subsequently happened, including the subsequently announced transaction with Rosneft, involving Glencore and the Kuwaiti Investment Authority, it matches perfectly the transaction that was described there, which no one knew about at that time. It was a very, very closely held secret at that time. So that suggests that the source had had impeccable access and command of information. That's very, very, very impressive. And now, then with the death on Boxing Day of Yerovinkin, I guess that would suggest that whether he was the source or not, it would suggest very strongly that Russian intelligence concluded that he most likely was the source, and they decided to take him out.
Well, just in closing, Scott Horton, what would be the quid pro quo in terms of Trump easing the sanctions? And on Thursday, they eased sanctions on the very organization that we're talking about, the FSB.
Well, I think that's the big question everyone should be asking. Because we're seeing a discussion of a series of proposals which involve releasing sanctions, recognition of Russian authority in Crimea, ending criticism of a range of their occupation of parts of Ukraine, tilts in Syria, tilts in Libya, and other things, with no concomitant concessions being made to the United States. It's strictly one way. And the suggestion of the Steele dossier is that there was a consideration offered and probably at some point accepted and taken by Trump for that. And I'm not talking about consideration to the United States or the United States government, but consideration to Donald Trump personally and his business empire. And that would, of course, be treason.
And that would involve the 5% commission on the...
Half percent.
Yeah, sorry, 0.5% on the 19.5% sale, or the sale of 19.5% of Rosneft's stock, right?
That's the suspicion. Now, of course, the Steele dossier itself reports that he did not accept this this offer. So it notes that that this and other things are being offered, but it never once records that he's actually accepted it. But I think this explains why that transaction is getting such intense scrutiny right now.
Well, on the other hand, you know, Politico's reporting that that Pence and Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell are doing everything they can to shut down the investigations at the Senate Intelligence Committee headed by this lackey of theirs, Senator Burr.
And Senator Burr, of course, was at the time all this was going on, the principal foreign policy advisor to Trump. So not an independent or dispassionate person. Yes. So I think there's a lot of concern about, you know, how an investigation can properly be unfolded at this point.
Well, Scott Horton, I thank you very much for joining us.
My great pleasure. Take care.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Scott Horton, who's a professor at Columbia Law School and is a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He served as counsel to Andrei Sakharov and Elena Bonner, among other activists in the former Soviet Union, and serves on the American branch of the International Law Association and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into the role of Eric Prince, the founder of Blackwater, and his relationship to Stephen Bannon and whether Prince might provide the spark to start a new war.
From Russia with love, I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Robert Young-Pelton, an author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer. He's the publisher of Dangerous Magazine and has a first-hand perspective on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi, rebel, and insurgent groups. His books include The World's Most Dangerous Places, Come Back Alive, Three Worlds Gone Mad, License to Kill, Hired Guns, and the War on Terror, and his autobiography, The Adventurist. He is currently a strategic advisor to the migrant offshore aid station, MOAS, who operates ships rescuing migrants at sea. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Young-Pelton.
Hey, Ian, how you doing?
Good, and I must congratulate you on the work that you're doing now, Robert, in terms of rescuing migrants in the Mediterranean, particularly off the coast of Libya, with this organization that you're involved with, the Migrant Offshore Aid Station. I understand that the British rock group Coldplay are funding your operation.
Yeah, they just signed on as patrons 2 days ago, and they're donating all the proceeds of their latest single to MOAS, which is very, very nice. And as you know, today, people not having a home is one of the biggest problems we have, with like 65 million people. And I think America is just coming to terms with that now with the recent ban. But Europe's been dealing with quite a large problem for many, many years.
Well, let's turn to the subject of Eric Prince, who apparently was with Trump and company on election night. His latest wife, Stacey DeLuke, posted pictures inside the Trump campaign headquarters on election night, of everybody celebrating. And of course, Prince's sister, billionaire Betsy DeVos, is Trump's nominee for education secretary. Eric Prince, he hired you to write a biography about him, but then when you wrote it, he didn't like what you wrote. Is that a brief description of your relationship? I know you've known him for a long time.
Yeah, I first met Eric in 2003 when he did his first interview for my book, License to Kill. And he had wanted to write a book that he was very unsuccessful in selling, and much of it contained a kind of roughly plagiarized stories from the Washington Post and things like that. I basically hired somebody and worked on it to rewrite it. I got him a $1 million deal with Adrian Zakheim, Penguin. And then for some magical reason, he thought that he didn't know who I was or why I was working on the book. So we were involved in some litigation. But, you know, his book's done very well, and he managed to get $2 million out of Penguin for it. They weren't happy paying twice for the book.
So but we know from the terrible massacre of Iraqi civilians in Iraq, I think it was in 2007, that after that, Blackwater was banned by the State Department, dropped them as a contractor. But as far as I know, they were never dropped by the CIA or Joint Special Operations Command. Is that true?
Yeah, I mean, most people don't realize that Eric worked on two fronts. One was the State Department contract, which was that very visible sort of escort service with, you know, large black SUVs barreling around Iraq. But the other one was supplying contractors to the CIA and other clandestine entities to such a point that, you know, he essentially became the CIA because he could operate and do things that the agency couldn't do. And when Nisr Square happened, what most people don't realize is that the State Department was physically unable to move around, meaning that they couldn't go out and go to meetings and things like that. And by banning Blackwater, you also had the same problem with the agency, where even though they were traveling in low-profile mode, they were basically prevented from moving around. So they had to somehow solve that problem. So what happened is, that, of course, when the Obama administration came in and Secretary of State Clinton came in, you know, they declared jihad on Eric and his company, and they had something like seven federal agencies investigating them, which included giving weapons to the King of Jordan and smuggling ammunition and dog food. So Eric left the country, and I did the last interview with him on the day that he left for the UAE.
And now he's set up in Hong Kong, and he's been working with the Chinese, with this new a group of his, Frontier Services Group.
Yeah, so what happened is that Eric continued working in a clandestine method, doing cutouts. So, you know, he was working with the Emiratis to set up a mercenary training organization called R2, or Reflex Response. He had a program in Somalia, and he was, you know, pitching these, he calls them relief with teeth, or these small mercenary armies to solve problems. He then began to support U.S. efforts through cutouts, in other words, through other countries, Jordan and the UAE. But what we saw on the surface was basically a very angry Eric Prince hiding in the UAE. But we didn't realize that he was busy working, doing pretty much the same thing, except much quieter. And then these things tend to blow up, just like Mr. Square. So I guess you could say he's America's useful idiot, and that he is the straw man for a lot of failed activities, like as you read in The Intercept and places like that, about his little Air Force and the ability or need to build these private militaries.
But he has a close relationship with Stephen Bannon, and Eric Prince was a regular on Breitbart News, which was owned at the time by I think it probably still is owned by Bannon. And he was at the election night celebrations, and he was also with Bannon at this annual dinner called Villains and Heroes Costume Ball, which is put on by the Mercers, these hedge fund people that bankroll the Trump campaign. And Rebecca Mercer, Robert Mercer's daughter, is very influential, close to Jared Kushner. and apparently a power behind the scenes there in the White House, where Bannon himself is now being described as a kind of Svengali figure or Rasputin type figure. So what's the relationship there? Because the concern that I've heard is that Bannon is looking around to start a little war, particularly when things get bad with all this ineptitude in the White House, and that he actually recently had a real severe clash with the new head of the CIA, Pompeo, who did not want that operation that recently happened in Yemen to go ahead, even though they'd been planning it for a long time because they didn't feel they were ready for it. But Bannon insisted that they go in, and of course the whole thing was a disaster. If it happened under Obama's watch, he would have been impeached. They would have had Benghazi-type hearings, but not a peep from the Republicans about this Yemen raid. So my sense is that that they might try and start something with the Iranians, and that Eric Prince, with his sort of secret little mercenary armies, could be the spark that fans the flames of war.
Yeah, so this is something that's very important to understand, that under President Obama, JSOC and these covert elements have been fighting wars using proxies, you know, partners and proxies in places like Yemen, Somalia, and they use other countries' troops, and then they feed them the equipment and the material they need. And then if something goes wrong, they can point at, let's say, an airstrike in Libya or in Yemen and say, oh, well, the Saudis were well beyond the realm of human rights, et cetera, et cetera. But it's actually all American-driven. And in Eric's case, Eric is providing a lot of technical support, and he is working very diligently with these groups to get them the technology that they need. Now, when Eric is operating as Greystone, which was sort of the agency version of Blackwater, one of his pet projects was to find a way to instigate a war with Iran. And if you understand the Green Badgers and the people that work for the agency, if you work for the CIA, you're restricted by a number of very, you know, strong legal barriers, you know, checks and balances. If a contractor is doing something and you're writing them a check, they are less restricted. And if you're using a foreign country, like let's say you're hiring Ugandan troops to fight Al-Shabaab in Somalia, then you're getting further and further away from responsibility. And this is where they began outsourcing risk to companies like Eric. So if Eric and his partners, the UA or somebody, does something irresponsible that then triggers an Iranian response, then it gives America the diplomatic space to do something, either pro or con. Now, under President Obama, it was a very, very risk-averse program. Under Trump, and as you mentioned Bannon, they are absolutely looking for a fight, because there is nothing better than to have a war president who literally takes control over the direction of the country because of the fear of a bigger problem. And Putin actually used this to his advantage when he began fighting wars in places like Chechnya and Georgia, et cetera.
So has Prince ever done anything like that? For example, it wouldn't take much, given the aggressive nature of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, with their speedboats zipping around in the Straits of Hormuz, which is only 20 miles wide at that choke point, into the Persian Gulf. It's absolutely full of tanker traffic, almost bumper to bumper. And these guys go zipping around. And Trump himself has said, you know, that he lamented that these Iranians could make rude gestures to the sailors on our beautiful warships and that we should do something about it. So he's already weighed in on this. So what's Prince done so far?
Well, Eric's already done that. If you look at Nisr Square, most people don't connect all the dots, but you can connect Nisr Square to the rise of ISIS. We had a status of forces agreement that was negotiated to our disadvantage because of the Iraqi government's hatred of our use of contractors and, of course, the unrestricted use of violence they could put on an Iraqi citizens. This led the Iraqi government to move towards Iranians as their supporters, which then led to the tribes that we used to pay, you know, the Anbaris and the Sunni groups, to then lean towards ISIS and invite them in. So don't forget, this has already happened. So going forward, if you see these ships that are being fired at or blown up in the straits, you know, just by if you look at the straits, there's two choke points. The UAE has already lost a very large ship, which was purchased to supply the troops in Yemen. There's been a number of violent incidents there. So this is happening on a regular basis.
Well, but this, so in other words, Stephen Bannon already has at his disposal the Oliver North's dream idea of having an off-the-books, off-the-shelf, mini-CIA paramilitary organization that you could secretly wield and not have to go through government channels.
Well, it's not CIA, so this is the key thing here. I've seen plenty of movies, you know, fictional movies about this idea. But the White House could have an asset overseas that is then tasked to do something that causes a very violent effect. Imagine Bay of Pigs or, you know, incidents where somebody's done something and it's caused a huge diplomatic backlash. Eric Prince already manages and creates large groups of armed men with aircraft and all the things that an army has. If you dig into his Operation Iron Fist, which was designed to protect the oil fields in South Sudan, I was with the rebels when that fight was happening, and you could imagine what would happen if gunships and close air support aircraft were then started massacring one tribal group over the other. So all these plans are in place. For example, he's got a plan that he presented to Spain and Italy to use ISR, in other words, call them spy aircraft, that also function as close air support against migrants in Libya in areas that they don't even control. So there's a lot of very wacky, violent plans that have already been presented by Eric Prince.
Well, and of course, there's a rumor that both Bannon and Eric Prince are members of the secret right-wing Catholic sect, Opus Dei. I know Prince's third wife, Stacey DeLuke, and he were married in the Vatican. I don't know whether there's anything to that, or whether it's with the Knights of Malta and all these other groups. But just
I don't think he works. He has a location in Malta where he runs some aviation stuff. He bought Malice Air. I don't think Eric's a member of SMOM, after my conversations with a few members. Opus Dei could be. It's a lay organization. It's not as scary as the movies lay out.
Right.
But I don't think Eric is a religious crusader. I think he converted to Roman Catholicism to marry his wives, and he's enjoyed that religion. But he's not a crusader per se. He literally lives in the UAE and is a... I don't know what the polite word is a servant of the Emiratis.
Right. Well, his sister makes up for it, Betsy DeVos.
Exactly. But these are, as you know, the princes are part of a very large, powerful part of the Republican fundraising and also, theology, if you want to call it that. And so they are now in power, and whether they are advisors or whether they're just going to a party because they know people, the pendulum has swung.
And he's got his guy right there in the right hand of the president, who may well be the right hand of the president. So I thank you for
thank you. Remember Cheney and his assassination program? These things never went away. They just got put on hold.
Right. Well, Robert Jungpelt, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Robert Jungpelt, and he's an author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer. He's the publisher of Dangerous Magazine and has had first-hand perspectives on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi, rebel, and insurgent groups. He's the author of License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, and his autobiography, The Adventurist, and he's currently a strategic advisor to the migrant offshore aid station, MOAS, who operates ships rescuing migrants at sea. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with investigative economist James Henry about the Secretary of Commerce nominee Wilbur Ross's connections to a Russian mobster who co-owns a bank with him in Cyprus, and also the 19% of Rosneft sales and the commission that might well have gone to Trump. We'll look into that further. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is James Henry, an investigative economist and lawyer who has written widely about offshore and onshore tax havens, kleptocracy, and pirate banking. He is the senior economics investigator at DC Reports, a senior fellow at the Columbia University Center for Sustainable Investment, a global justice fellow at Yale University, a senior advisor at the Tax Justice Network, and a member of the New York Bar. And his latest book is Blood Bankers. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Henry.
Good to be with you.
Thank you, Jim. And tell us about this new investigative organization that you have formed with David K. Johnston, DC Reports.
Well, this just started, launched last week. It's, had a lot of good response. We're focusing very much on the day-to-day back and forth across the spectrum of all the Trump administration's policies. I have a strong focus on the offshore industry and on international economic issues, issues like trade deficits, his crazy theory about currency manipulation, stuff like that. But yeah, we're quite excited. David K. Johnston is a longtime New York Times reporter. He's a Pulitzer Prize winner. Wrote a book about Trump, which I think to this date called The Making of Donald Trump, which is probably the best thing out there to understand this guy, and just has a long history of doing outstanding investigative reporting. So our focus is really not on opinion or, kind of continuing, denunciations of the Trump administration. I think there's plenty of people doing that. We're just trying to get at the facts. And it's also, I would say, a nonpartisan endeavor. We, both come from backgrounds that are independent politically. And I think, we had definitely had preferences in the last election. But, I think there are a lot of issues here that we've, surfaced that are going to concern Republicans, Democrats, conservatives, liberals, people right across the board, anyone who's concerned about the future of this country.
Well, Jim, let's talk about I want to talk to about the new work that you've uncovered about Wilbur Ross, who's up to be Commerce Secretary, a billionaire, and his partnership with the Russian mobster and money launderer in a bank in Cyprus where the Russian oligarchs launder their money. I believe that this bank has even been listed on the London Stock Exchange, but let's hold that off for a minute because I wanted to do a follow-up on our first guest, Scott Horton, talking about the 19.5% of the sale of Rosneft secretly done, and nobody knows who the beneficiaries were. The money ended up in all kinds of Cayman Island cutouts. And the speculation is that from the Steele dossier that Donald Trump was given a commission, which could be to the tune of billions of dollars. So what did you think of of Scott Horton's analysis, and what could you add to that?
Well, I think, first of all, he seemed to have read my American Interest piece about the origins of Trump and Putin back in December, talking about the enormous amount of Russian flight capital that poured out of that country and, in fact, the whole former Soviet Union, precisely at the time when Trump was unable to find any financing elsewhere. And that really helped him through the critical period here, 2000 to 2008, when nobody else would really lend him money. So I refer people to that article if they want to get sort of the background and perspective on this overall thing. It's in the American Interest. I think the second thing we there are things we can safely say about this transaction in December. And then there's a lot that we just don't know. So it's a little bit premature to say that we have all the details required to definitely say that the president has acquired 19% of one of the world's largest traded oil companies.
Well, now that charge wasn't made. It was that he got a 0.5% commission.
I think the idea was that the 19.5% that was discussed in the Reuters report that came out on January 25th, for a transaction that had been announced in January, coincided very neatly with the 19% that was mentioned in the Chris Steele document last summer and has been floating around. So it is an interesting correspondence, the idea that 19% of Rosneft was offered to the president in exchange for
dropping sanctions by way of a conversation between alleged to have occurred between Sessions and Carter Page, this gadfly of the Trump campaign, and the fact that on December 7th, 2017, after the election, Rosneft suddenly announces that it has sold 19.5% to a joint venture between Glencore and Qatar. It turns out that Glencore only accounted for precisely 0.54% of that and only contributed about 300 million euros out of the 10.2 billion euros that was involved. So I think it was Glencore that may have swallowed the commission here. The issue really comes down to who holds the ownership in this company, because it's basically not transparent at all. Qatar, we know, says it put up $2.5 billion out of the 10.2. And a curious Italian bank, Intesa San Paolo, put up another 5.2. The guarantor for that 5.2 billion euros was a London holding company, QHG Shares, basically guaranteed the 5.2 billion. And the ultimate holding company is that in which the London company is an investor is in Singapore. But upstream of that, there's another company, a Cayman Island company, QHG Cayman, that seems to have supplied about 2 billion euros to this thing. So all told, the only identified clear sources for all the funding here is Qatar, 2.5 billion, and 300 million from the Swiss-based Glencore company, which, you know, goes back to Mark Rich. So the whole thing is, you know, it's very hard to know who is actually providing the cash here, you know, who owns QHG. All of this is, very murky. And it looks like what the Russians call a matryoshka of one of these Russian dolls of shell companies designed to conceal who the ultimate owners are. And, you know, I think it's premature to say that we know this went to anyone, you know, near the Trump administration, but I think the coincidence with the Steele memo has got people, certainly excited about understanding more. And certainly if there was going to be any kind of decent Senate investigation or a special prosecutor or any kind of investigation, this would be one of the things that we would want to look into much more closely with subpoena power.
Well, we know that that the money simply doesn't add up, does it? 19% of Rosneft would be many, many, many billions.
Yeah, I mean the transaction price was 10.2 billion. Maybe that's fair market value, but we know that 75% of it came from unknown sources, and it's just not clear who actually owns those companies now. So, if let's say hypothetically in the conspiracy theories dream world, we were saying, well, Putin has much more money than that in the world, and he could easily finance that, and then he could transfer the shares to anybody he liked. We wouldn't know about it because there's no disclosure of beneficial ownership by the Cayman Islands.
So James Henry, again, investigative economist, a lawyer, and founder of the new investigative organization DC Reports, and his latest book is Blood Bankers. Let's talk a little bit about then the Commerce Secretary, who has not been confirmed yet, as far as I know, Wilbur Ross. He's a billionaire, and he has a partnership in a bank in Cyprus. And Cyprus, of course, is the notorious money laundering hub for Russian oligarchs.
That's right. And I think December 16th, 2016, Mother Jones published an article, which I think I recommend everybody, on Wilbur Ross and his involvement in Bank of Cyprus. Bank of Cyprus is a notorious institution that has long been a kind of money launderer for Russian money. And, it basically made such bad investments that during the Greek crisis, it failed and it had to be bailed out effectively by the ECB. So in 2015, Ross shows up. Wilbur Ross is the hedge fund guy who has been appointed to be Secretary of Congress, of Commerce in the new administration. Ross showed up and put up €1 billion euros to buy 17% of the Bank of Cyprus. He became vice chairman of the bank July 2015. And he had, you know, at the time when he joined the bank, the other vice chairman was a guy named Vladimir, this is going to test my Russian, but Strzelkovsky, who is a former KGB member. His other investors in the bank, and this is where I got interested in this, was, first of all, a fellow named Viktor Vekselberg, who is a Russian garch who dominated the aluminum industry, is estimated to be worth, you know, $14 billion. And his other co-investor that's interesting is a fellow named Dmitry Ribolovlev, who is the potash king, or was the potash king of Russia. The reason I was interested and struck by the fact that all these people were invested in this bank alongside Ross was that I had tracked Dmitry Ribolovlev. He's the guy that bought Trump's house in Miami, one of his two houses in Miami, in 2008 for $95 million. This is a property that Donald Trump had purchased in 2004 for just $40 million. So this was an incredible return on investment for a property that was, you know, contaminated by mold. The house had to be torn down. Anyway, so Ribolovlev was involved in that nice transaction for Donald Trump. In 2016, during the election, Ribolovlev's Airbus 319, a huge plane, ends up basically bird-dogging Trump's presidential campaign train plane all over the United States. I mean, he's in Charlotte, North Carolina, when Trump is there. He's in Las Vegas when Trump is there. There's pictures of their planes side by side on the rain in the airport. He's in Concord, and you know, he's also shows up in the Hamptons in August. This is this Airbus that had, as far as I could tell from looking at the flight patterns during the prior 6 months, had never been to the United States. It was flying out of Moscow, out of Switzerland, out of Monaco. Well, Ribolovlev also turns out to own between 5% and 9% of the Bank of Cyprus. So this is kind of, you know, it's another interesting coincidence that right now where I think we are is we have smoke coming out of a lot of different sources here. And what we really need to have is some serious, you know, Senate commission or Senate committee actually investigate some of these things, because it's just hard to make this look like, you know, just a set of circumstances.
But I understand, though, that the Trump organization has a number of airplanes and that they try to scrub the FAA logs of their activities during that same period when Ribolovlev's Airbus 319 was parked beside Trump's plane at various airports across the United States.
Well, the what we know is that the holding company for eight Gulfstream planes, and there are a couple, I think seven of them are Gulfstream 650s, and there's one of them that's not, but they're all in a holding company that has the same business address as Michael Cohen, who is Trump's personal lawyer. We have indeed tried to track, you know, those places that have been with some success to look at, you know, where those planes were flying during this period. But Trump went out of his way to delete his flight records from, you know, Flight Radar 24 and other web applications that actually track planes all over the place. So, you know, that has remains incomplete. But I think what we do know, the Bank of Cyprus was just, by the way, listed on the, despite its tiny track record, was listed on the London Stock Exchange just this month. It's it's interesting because the CEO that Wilbur Ross actually brought into the bank was the former CEO of Deutsche Bank, Joseph Ackerman, who basically ran Deutsche Bank with a great during a period in which he was heavily involved in all kinds of crimes, generated lots of fines that it's now suffering for. The latest of which was a $650 million fine for money laundering, $10 billion of money out of Moscow. All of this happened on Ackerman's watch. He then is chosen by Wilbur Ross because of this distinctive track record to be president, CEO of the Bank of Cyprus in July 2015. They just set up an Irish holding company, that was floated on the London Stock Exchange with a new CEO who was former chairman of RBS, another failed bank. It's amazing to me that the Brits have allowed this bank to be listed. Technically speaking, they are, they're allowing the Irish holding company to be listed. But behind the scenes here, the real owners of this bank are Wilbur and his Russian pals. And, they're based in Cyprus. But under British rules, they don't allow Cyprus banks to be listed on the London Stock Exchange. So they had to create this dodge.
Well, we're afraid we've run out of time, James Henry, and of course it's worth tracking these planes, Michael Cohen being the lawyer for Trump, who runs these holding companies for these aircraft. He's also in the Steele dossier of having gone to Prague to set up some meetings with Russian oligarchs on Trump's behest, and that still remains to be proven. I thank you for joining us, James Henry.
Well, I'm delighted to join you. I just think we have to press the Congress to get involved in investigating a lot of the leads that we're turning up. It's a critical time for this.
Well, thank you. And again, I've been speaking with James Henry, an investment economist and lawyer who's written widely about offshore and onshore tax havens, kleptocracy, and pirate banking. He's the senior economics investigator at the new organization DC Reports and a senior fellow at Columbia University Center for Sustainable Investment, a global justice fellow at Yale University, and a senior advisor at the Tax Justice Network and a member of the New York Bar. And his latest book is Blood Bankers. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.